moments. Hello and welcome to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. It must be 3 p.m. on Tuesday. We're here taping at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn on a steamy, steamy day. Today's guest, a very interesting, intriguing woman, Natalie Jeremijenko. She is the director of the Environmental Health Clinic at NYU, an associate professor of art, computer science, and environmental studies, with a PhD in space system engineering. I bet you're all wondering what that has to do with food and or art, but plenty. She, for years, has been creating these kind of interfaces, these ideas, social, political, things that, you know, affect each other that you wouldn't necessarily think are corollary. First read about her project called, the slightly morose Suicide Box, relating the Dow Jones Index to people jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. And more along the food line, a 1999 project called One Trees, where she cloned walnut trees and planted them amongst in San Francisco. Is that correct?
In San Francisco, in pairs, so that over the years you'll see there was 100 genetically identical, black walnut hybridized. Well, it's a paradox tree actually, which is a black walnut and an F1 hybrid.
So it has both elements on the same tree.
It's called the paradox tree because Luther Burbank named it that. It was the first example of hybrid vigor.
Yeah.
So you had a puny English walnut tree that crossed with a native Californian black walnut, and they created this monster tree that has since been used as rootstock in commercial walnut production. And so there's a lot of genetic interest in this.
So it's like a precursor to the GMO movement, the larger hybridization of certain vegetables and fruits.
It was actually precisely at and about that issue.
Yeah.
Because we took these clone trees and we planted them in pairs in different microclimates and different contexts throughout the San Francisco Bay Area, so that over the next 60 years, we'll be able to see the difference within between the pairs and within the pairs, right? Just how much how much do the genes matter?
Yeah.
How much does you can really see that with these.
Yeah.
So there's a biannual bike ride we call the Tour de San Francisco.
The Tour de San Francisco.
And the One Trees Two Wheeling event. And in there we actually have kind of a conference on wheels where we talk about the growth responses and what's going on.
So, they are bearing fruit, not right now, that is digestible. It's not.
The thing about the paradox tree and the mule and all of these other F1 hybrids that exhibit unusual vigor is that they put the energy that would otherwise go into reproduction into growth.
Yeah.
That's why you have mules, right? Because they're not actually very good at reproducing.
Yeah.
Same is true with the paradox tree, but they do produce these little proto nuts. But in fact, as I was trying to convince the San Francisco Public Works Department that I could plant these street trees with the help of, this is before the urban forestry movement really got off, but with a great deal of help from the Friends of the Urban Forest in San Francisco and the Exploratorium and many other people, but they were very concerned about the tripping hazard.
Yeah.
Right? That these trees will bear fruit. Yes. Trees do that, right?
So it sounds like they didn't think of the efficiency over the ephemeral nature of, just having these beautiful trees that were, like you said, mules and,
They're never quite mules, right? But the idea that we treat these fruit-producing, food-producing engines, you know, carbon sequestering, extraordinary, the new citizens of every urban center, trees. We treat them as images, as kind of static little elements for decorating, this neatly spacing along the street, and not as dynamic adaptive systems that are in fact whole habitats that support many other organisms that produce fruit, and it's part of their ecosystem's function that, you know, improve the air quality and the water quality and do all these other critical environmental services. So kind of really changing the cultural imagination to understand trees as infrastructure and valuable and critical parts of our urban lifestyles is a big shift that, of course, most bureaucracies have not yet digested.
Well, I think you also proved a point during your... what is the title of the Fish on Zoloff project?
That's actually called Amphibious Architecture Towards a Fish Restaurant.
Yeah, it was a very interesting study where she set up 100 polycarbonate buoys in the Hudson River, and they would glow when fish swam past.
Yeah, it wasn't quite 100.
Yeah. But okay. We'll say for imagination, many buoys in the Hudson River. And they would glow when fish swam past.
Let me just correct a little. So there was two layers of lights. There was a top layer of lights that shifted, it was always on, shifted from a warm red color to a cool blue or green color when dissolved oxygen was low or high. And so it was a display of water quality. The bottom layer of lights, which was right on the water, whenever a fish swam under, a school of fish, they would light up. So you would see the fish would leave a trail of light through the array of buoys. So a low-resolution display of fish presence.
Yes, it was kind of luminescence.
It was. But then, so, you know, the first question people asked when they went, there was two installations of it in the Bronx River and the East River simultaneously. And people, of course, asked, are there fish?
Yeah.
And, of course, they saw, there's fish there. And then the interesting thing is what happens next, right? Because now you know that there are, you know, that you have these non-human organisms as neighbors, you know, what do you do? So you text them, naturally enough, and they text back. And you initiate a relationship. So there's business cards with the organisms and their contact details if you want to, you know, schmooze with your
rub elbows with the fish.
Yes, exactly. So, sup scup. You could follow the scup and get updates from the herring. And the most popular organism, non-human organism in the Amphibious Architecture Towards a Fish Restaurant project was the beaver, which was is still the only and the first beaver to build a lodge in New York City in over 200 years.
Yeah, so. And that beaver is housed where now?
Well, he's housed under his own steam with a little help from me, unwittingly.
Yeah.
Because he took the cable that we were securing the Amphibious Architecture Array and, you know, clearly inspected it and thought, oh, this is strong and durable and this would be good for building a lodge.
Exactly what I needed. Exactly. Thank you, Natalie.
And he cut out a nice big... It took us weeks to figure out what was going on. There was nothing wrong with the software. There was nothing wrong with the sensors. The buoys were all working. Yeah. We had just not counted on the beaver, you know, being a marvelously adaptive urban organism using the materials he had available to produce whatever he...
But I don't want to lose sight of the fish, actually. We'll return to the beaver shortly. Where did you find in your data that there was a kind of an odd or interesting anomaly that was happening, and how did you convince the environmental, officials to allow this project to show that there was a problem happening in the rivers?
Well, you know, the thing is that water quality is very complicated, and the fact that we have a medieval storm combined sewage overflow system.
I grew up in Croydon and Hudson, so I've seen the dam.
Okay, yes. So the there's actually been a lot of studies. I think what you're asking about is the SSRIs that the fish are on.
Yeah.
That actually came from earlier work by a number of scientists. Who turns out that these SSRIs, antidepressants like Zoloft and Prozac and a number of other associated ones, are kind of novel molecules that aren't found anywhere. So we know when we find them in fish where they've come from.
Right? Yeah.
They've come from pharmaceuticals. And so in the Whitney
Bay... You don't think there's like a little fish drug dealer swimming around the Hudson?
I don't know. Or there's someone, some kid out there who's taking feet. I don't know. It actually, it becomes a wonderful trace of just how connected we are to these organisms. By reverse, the major source of mercury in your body and my body and the breast milk of the American woman and in the cord blood of the newborn American baby is from mercury, is from fish, the major source is actually. So we're in a kind of feedback cycle, if you will, what we're ingesting, they're ingesting, and what they're ingesting, we're ingesting. And that's the essential structure, that's mutualistic coupled systems approach that is really difficult for us to culturally understand and to respond to.
Yeah.
And I think it changes our whole, what it is we can do about the, massive environmental systems.
Kind of like
issues.
This unintentional symbiosis that's happening that people don't realize they're part of this greater, infrastructure.
Exactly. Most people wouldn't realize that they're intimately connected, that they're sharing their, reproductive pill or antidepressants, their pharmaceuticals, their medicine cabinet with the local organisms.
What they're actually paying affects what they eat. Didn't want to have to put it as blunt as that.
That's right. So, but there's a couple of editions of the frequent the nutrition facts, but it's FAQS, which is frequently or infrequently asked questions. And actually, the exhibit in the Whitney a couple of biennials ago.
Yeah.
It traced that when you pee in the toilets at the Whitney, where these antidepressants or pharmaceuticals that you are on, where they go through the New York City water infrastructure and then through the community structure of the food web that we depend on, so through the birds. And it turns out, of course, that fish, the remaining amphibians and the birds are all on antidepressants. So,
I mean, I just find it fascinating to think that, literally excrement or what people kind of use as an end process of a meal is actually affecting the meal itself.
Exactly.
I mean, people know compost, people know manure go into farms, but don't realize that they're additives being put in food or ingested separately of the meal actually are affecting certain ingredients per se. And
absolutely. And I think that's where this idea that nature is somewhere else, that nature is in a little box that we call a park or a big box we call Yellowstone National Park, or that, or somewhere outside, that it's actually nature is, these natural systems are in the air we breathe, the food we are so intimately and viscerally connected that this kind of delusion is that nature is somewhere else, that it's a pretty image that you escape to and take a vacation in or go camping in, is like a delusion that's really problematic. And certainly what I call sort of the conservation or preservation environmentalism, that relates very much to preserving the rural agricultural production, this kind of sentiment about that image of the First Lady with her 17th century pitchfork and the 17th century vegetable garden in the White House was, it's just not productive.
Yeah.
It's not, because we are agents in this system, right? We are interacting whether or not we believe we are.
Yeah.
And so I call it suicide environmentalism, that this idea that, I call it suicide environmentalism because a couple of my students have independently come to me and said, if I'm an environmentalist, and I print on both sides of my paper, and I don't eat meat, and and I really watch my diet, and I don't drive, I take public transportation, but wouldn't the best thing for me to do is to suicide, right? Because then, my carbon footprint will be less, I'll eat even less meat, right, products. This idea that the way that we can act in the world is all about what we can't do, as opposed to what we can do, and that we have the capacity to make that good.
Yeah, and I mean, do you have an idea or a list of things that you suggest to people that they can do to even lower their carbon footprint? I mean, what are the first things? Is it eliminate your car? Is it ride the subway? Is it eat less meat?
Well, yeah, the Environmental Health Clinic is actually set up to address the environmental health issues that people have. So anyone can make an appointment. It works like a, you know, a health clinic at any other university, except people who come, you know, come with their environmental health concerns, and they walk out with prescriptions for things they can do to...
And it's environmentalhealthclinic.net, correct?
Yes, exactly. And so the people who come are called inpatients rather than patients because they're too impatient to wait for traditional legislative responses to improve environmental health. And so it's not a menu of here's the 10 things you can do to save the world by any means.
Yeah.
It's drawing on the particular lifestyle and concerns, you know, starting with the actual concerns of a person to create these lifestyle experiments and these co-produce these projects that can measurably improve environmental health, because we don't know the answers. There isn't a simple list of formulas. We need the creative energy and the exploration and the, you know, the work of an experimentation, what I call lifestyle experiments. Yes.
Well, what I thought was interesting, a prior project that you had done, is it called Zooz? Z-O-O-Z.
Ooze is zoo backwards and without cages, and that's an institutional framework for a whole set of interfaces between human and non-human organisms in urban contexts.
But I thought it was a very interesting way of bridging the gap. What Natalie does is kind of create these actions that humans do that mirror that of non-humans or animals. So you get an understanding, you know, putting somebody in somebody else's shoes, in a sense. And
so you can drive your goose avatar and interact with actual geese and your robotic goose avatar that you wear a little screen sunglasses with a goose nose. But you can talk to the geese, so you can issue pre-recorded goose words saying hi, or, you know, through ventriloquism you can do your own imitation of goose language. And then the robotic goose will sample back 2 to 4 seconds of what the biological geese do back. And through this as a collective intelligence process, I would argue and have tremendous evidence that we can actually learn goose.
Yeah. What other animals have you put in this experiment?
Quite a number. The Neuberger Museum of Art, there's currently an exhibition of ooze and a number of other projects, the Environmental Health Clinic projects, and how stuff is made and how it can change, and the Bureau of Inverse Technology. So they're there. One of the things that's there, it's addressing rhinoceros beetles, which are really the heroes of the underworld and the strongest animals in the world.
Yeah.
So this is a interface that sets up man versus beast, the strongest animal in the world, and it's a rhinoceros beetle wrestling device that scales human forces down to rhinoceros beetle scale and rhinoceros beetle scale up to human forces.
Yeah.
So you can take on the strongest animal in the world, and I can take wages on man versus beast.
Yeah. How many fights have actually occurred?
Three, and there were several injuries.
Yeah. So I'm assuming I'll go to the rhinoceros beetle. 3-0 for him, all knockouts. The rhinoceros beetle beat the human in all instances.
Actually, it's not clear. I mean, we've got to get the motivation working. I tend to challenge, on behalf of the rhinoceros beetles, the kind of icons of masculinity, the kind of Hemingway-esque characters that you know, like museum directors and architects and, you know, constructors. Bruno Latour, we've just issued an interesting challenge to wrestle the rhinoceros beetle. And so we have several species, actually. We have 7 pairs of the rhinoceros beetles in the Neuberger Museum currently. We have to... There has to be girls there for the boys to be ready to fight, right? But they're extraordinary organisms. They're amazing. You know, they are this idea that they they are the caterpillars of the underworld, if you will, the yellow heavy lifting equipment of the underworld. You know, they churn up this extraordinary strength. What's it for? You know, in this absolute, they're like a VW beetle that can fly with little 10-foot transparent wings, and it's as if a VW, a had an elk on it,
yeah,
attached as the figurehead, right? And they're biomechanically impossible,
yeah,
right, to translate it into a scale that we're more familiar with. They can carry a building on them, right? 40 times their weight, right? They're just so to have a visceral and wrestling event with them is, you know, a way to really experience.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back to more man versus animal. And we have not forgotten about the beaver. We're going to tell you more about him soon. Michael Harlan Turkel, you're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. Back. This is Michael Harlan Turkel, and you're listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I first wanted to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef since 1865. Didn't want to slight them in 100 years. The Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more info, go to www.hearstranch.com. And I'm back with Natalie Jeremijenko, the director of the Environmental Health Clinic at NYU. And priorly, we were talking about her
amphibious architecture project.
Yeah.
Towards a fish restaurant.
Exactly. She just wanted to clarify how it related back to the fish restaurant.
Right. Because we're talking about food.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
We are talking about food. You know, so roundabout, but
not just drugs.
Yeah.
So the issue with the why this interface sets up interaction, what happens with wherever there's urban animals, wherever there's animals, there's always a sign, do not feed the animals.
Yeah.
And you've got to ask, why? Why yeah. not feed the animals? And you know, the idea is that, oh, you'll interfere with them, right? Or you'll make them dependent on you.
Because by putting a sign there, you didn't interfere with their...
Right. Or by,
yeah.
by driving along the freeway that cuts off the migration route to Yellowstone National Park.
Yeah.
You know, you've limited their nutritional resources.
Exactly. I see no hand in man there.
Right. We're changing the entire global climate. Yes, we're interfering yeah. with the animals. So can we, in fact, make that interference good. So the amphibious architecture interface, like any other interface, you know, immediately people know there's animals there. They reach in and they grab a Dorito or, you know, chewing gum or whatever they have to hand. That sign, do not feed the animals, is only as ubiquitous as the desire to do so.
Yeah.
So we get this exchange, which we'd really like to make better. So we developed a lure, a fishing lure. The hook is there is no hook.
Yeah.
It's actually nutritionally appropriate. So a school bus full of kids can, oh, there's fish there. And then they can offer actually nutritionally appropriate food that could augment the fish population. Moreover, what we've included in the lure is a chelating agent called chitinase, which is a medical grade product used to treat you if you had mercury poisoning. When the fish ingest it through the lure, it binds to the bioaccumulated heavy metals and PCBs, complexes, and then passes out as a harmless salt, right? So it's less yeah. reactive, and it settles into the silt and is effectively removed from bioavailability. So not only can you set up a collective significant environmental remediation, just out of that kind of desire to interact with the animals, that desire to be recognized. And of course, the fish realize what lights go on. Food is likely to appear. People realize the lights that go on. Oh, fish likely to be there. And we set up a feedback cycle that can be positive, generative, and can augment our biodiversity and our environmental health.
Yeah, that. I mean, it's both happy and sad that it's come to this. In that, it's happy because it's aggregating, you know, interest. Mm-hmm. But it's sad to think that you have to put all these bells and whistles associated with trying to, in a sense, purify not just the fish, but the idea of where the fish live. Right. That you have to, you know, have lights, that you have to have sustenance, healthy sustenance, to then, you know, dole out to these, you know, aquatic creatures. So, I mean, there are all these things that hopefully through rote will become natural.
Yes, and I think we need to not just the technical solutions, but we also need the institutional reframing, which is why towards the fish restaurant, of course, is where you feed fish rather than eat them.
Yeah.
But this whole cross-species food that we actually share nutritional resources, that we actually, you know, that what the fish eat, we eat, you know, that we're connected. That's hard for people to digest. So we've framed that as, initiated a cross-species supper club called the Cross-Species Adventure Club with Emily Bolt and with Mihir Desai and with Catherine Kramer, who you're having on soon, I hope. And this is a way, the Cross Species Adventure Club is incredible meals where we can really explore the ecological interrelationships. That the idea that, you know, what geese eat.
Yeah.
We don't eat the goose dinner, we don't eat the goose, we eat what the goose eats, right? So in that way we realize, oh, we eat the same stuff.
Yeah, so it's once removed.
Right. Yeah. We eat the same stuff, we live inside the same system, we depend on the same resources. What's in their interest is in my interest, as opposed to this kind of ethnic cleansing we have going on at the moment of shooting all the geese.
Euthanized in Prospect Park.
You know, out. Round them into tanks and gas them, right? That's these horrifying images of treating other organisms in this way that we've had in the past, that we need to kind of figure out how we can do that better. So the charge of the Cross Species Adventure Club, which is really the most food-related work, is what's not food-related, right, is to, you know, that we can design our food systems not just that they reduce the distribution costs or the exploitative labor practices. It's not just about reducing the negative impact of our food production systems, but we can actually design food systems that augment biodiversity and improve environmental health. And that's the charge of the Cross Species Adventure Club.
What I also found fascinating is also the idea of regeneration. Specific side example was seeing a video of you eating a salamander, or was it newt tail?
Salamander tail.
Could you explain a little more about that?
Well, that's a series of from the Lifestyles of the Wet and Slimy chapter and dinner, where we're exploring wetlands, because actually this whole northeast area that we live in is really a machine for producing salamanders.
Yeah.
If we rolled all the amphibians into a ball, frogs and salamanders, and rolled all the vertebrates into a ball, all the deer and coyote and, you know, rabbits and squirrels and mice and things into a ball, the size of the amphibian ball would be four times that of the vertebrate ball.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what we produce around here really well, really easily. So how do we figure out how to work with this particular ecosystem, what's abundant in this ecosystem? And salamanders, because they have such predatory pressure on them because of their number, they feed, the energy transfer that they affect between the ecosystem and birds and vertebrates is extraordinary. But they've developed a monopoly on the technology of limb, regrowing your
like
limb.
Like starfish, you cut off a leg and it grows back.
And they'll grow it back. So that can be up to half their body mass. So they can, there's one species of salamander that can drop it at will,
their
tail. So it's more like milking a cow, and it gets us towards what is probably one of the grand challenges of the 21st century, victimless meat. If we can produce a meat that vegetarians eat, right, which is one of the goals of the Cross Species Adventure Club, what meat would vegetarians eat? Augments environmental health, increases the biodiversity, would that be palatable?
Yeah.
And I would argue maybe it would be. So that's the salamander tail cocktail.
Yeah.
Gets us towards exploring what this particular ecosystem can produce.
Can you explain a little about the plating of the dish? Because I found that also very exhilarating. It was a salamander tail with like a pipette stuck, you know, in the tail as a serving device and sumac solution.
Yeah. This is... I have to give credit where credit is due. Mihir Desai, who is the molecular gastronomist that I work with, came up with this idea of how to make it, just really a spectacular experience where the salamander tail, I've not yet figured out how to reap salamander tail. So that was actually a gel and molded salamander tail.
Yeah. you don't have a salamander tail plucking farm.
I don't. Yeah,
not yet.
But we. Anyone out there interested, I can. I'd support it. Mihir's worked to produce a delicious cognac cocktail that was then you shot the living organism would actually have a. There's a shot of blood that comes after it, but that's a really tart sumac deliciousness that was a chaser to the tail.
What were a couple of the other dishes, either during past Cross X Species Adventure Club meals or an upcoming one, which is happening soon?
Yeah, on the 21st, Saturday the 21st at the Neuberger Museum, where we're really looking at cooking with oil, and that is the ecological effects of the oil spill, which is... doesn't sound delicious, but I promise you it will be. Towards that, and the current fascination, the main center of research is on wetlands, and wetlands are a critical ecosystem that we, are culturally in the swamps, right, in the bogs. They kind of we've not yet realized that they are the best ecosystem for sequestering carbon dioxide. They're biodiversity hotspots. They're critical for protecting both the marine ecosystem and the freshwater aquatic ecosystem, and for protecting the soil and the terrestrial ecosystem. Right? These are only originally 8% of the entire U.S. landmass, but they did all of this incredible work, and we still have ongoing wetland loss.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I mean, it's same thing with rainforests around the world. Everyone knows the Rainforest Alliance, but I mean, there is also the Wetlands Preservation Fund. And
So these are exploring wetlands as a new cultural resource is one of the... things we'll be talking and have done a lot of menu development around. The upcoming dinner, wetlands are, of course, the best defense. There's a lot of talk about we have to protect the wetlands. No, in fact, wetlands are the things that will help us digest the oil, will help the oil. The wetlands can take these kind of, they're resilient ecosystems that we don't understand very well, but we need them, and we need massive amounts of them for dealing with the extraordinary oil spill that we have. But to explore what it is the wetlands can do, there's a whole series of in-flight menu, which I'll explain. There's a connection.
Well,
in fact, most of the major wetlands have been degraded in the name of flight, and the FAA has created a new class of aircraft called the Light Sport Aircraft, which is there's 35 planes coming out on this. It's now $3,000 in a weekend to get a pilot's license, and you and I could use this as an opportunity to radically change how we get around. But several of the planes that are coming out are, like the U.S. Airways landing last year, realized, we have all this infrastructure that's wet, so let's do amphibious planes, let's do wet landings. And so instead of airports, which of course are all built on cheap, flat, swampy land that was nearby and now is actually understood as critical wetlands.
Yeah.
JFK, LaGuardia, we could in fact use this as an opportunity to build wetland landing strips, wet landings, if you will, to create these biodiversity hotspots. So there's a whole in-flight menu of cocktails, that explore wet landings, because flying is all about landing.
Yeah.
So one of the other really yummy, my favorite dish from the edible cocktail in-flight menus is something called Wet Kisses, a marshmallow for a frog formerly known as Prince, which is a marshmallow, of course, a wetland marshmallow.
Yeah.
That is also actually a cognac violetta base, but has in it an ingredient called levitum, and it's the purple actually is augmented by what levitum, which is a ubiquitous soil bacteria associated with wetlands, that is the only protection that we have in the greatest species extinction crisis the world is currently facing. So since the dinosaurs, frogs and amphibians are now disappearing at a rate that we've never seen before, mainly that one of the big culprits is the chytrid fungus, which is something that has come out of the global distribution of African clawed frogs, which were used for pregnancy tests. Right. So they used to take the urine of potentially pregnant women, inject it under the skin of a male or a female African clawed frog, and then if they produced an egg sac or sperm sac, they'd write you back and say, oh, you're pregnant.
Right, that they'd write you back. It wasn't just a plus minus at that time on the stick. Yeah.
That's right. It was. So these things are, these African claw frogs who endemically had the chytrid fungus in their microbial community on their skin, you know, were released when we went to paper-based and other forms of. So since the 70s, they've kind of become invasive throughout Australia, the U.S., South America, throughout Europe, and the chytrid fungus, the only thing that the frogs and salamanders have, it moves down the river, just you see hundreds of belly-up frogs just killed by this chytrid fungus.
Yeah.
The thing that protects them on their skin microbial community is this levitum, right, that produces a powerful anti-purple, antifungal, violosium, and so that's what's in the Wet Kisses marshmallow, so that when you actually bite into the marshmallow, your lips are inoculated with levitum and equip you to kiss any frog that you might come across.
Wonderful.
and save them from the deadly chytrid fungus.
That is just an absolutely wonderful end to this fascinating talk. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but do you know that you still have tickets available for the Cross-Ex Species Adventure Club?
Yes, we do.
Excellent. So, you know, contact Natalie through the environmentalhealthclinic.net. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use this horrible pun, but levitum it up, you know? Help out the wetlands and understand your relationship past just where your food comes from, but where your food lives. And I hope this was an enjoyable and enlightening show. This is Michael Harlan Turkel, your host of The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you again to Hearst Ranch for sponsoring. And shout out to Jack Inslee, our producer, and Nat Wiener, our engineer. And I hope to see you back here next Tuesday, 3 p.m. Cheers.